The following presentation is brought to you by RITA, the Rudyard Institute for Transpersonal Activity, a nonprofit public benefit corporation dedicated to disseminating the work and essential message of Dane Rudyard. All material is copyrighted by Layla Rudyard Hill. If you'd like to learn more about RITA or make a donation towards supporting the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardaudioarchives.com. We hope you enjoy the following presentation of A Modern I Ching, The Sabian Symbols, Part 1, by Dane Rudyard. This recording is 45 minutes long.
Now the title, as you know, is A Modern I Ching, and a New Interpretation of the Sabian Symbols. Many people use I Ching as an oracle, asking for advice and guidance, but I feel that not too many really understand what the I Ching is and either what an oracle is. And of course, the same is true to a large extent, or even greater extent perhaps, of the astrologers who use the Sabian symbols. Those Sabian symbols, as we will see in a moment, were found in my book, Astrology of Personality, and maybe you have seen them there, and in some of the books of Mark Jones. And we will tell about what they were in a moment. But first, I would like to give a background of what those symbols, whether they are those of the I Ching or those of the Sabian symbols, really are, what they represent, what is the basis on which they operate. Most people, unfortunately, are perfectly content to use a technique or a procedure of one kind or another, and at the same time, never bother to try to find on what foundation that technique is based, what is back of it, how to justify it, how to understand what it really gives you. And if you do that, of course, I think it is not terribly good for your consciousness, even if it works. Everybody is hypnotized in America by the fact that certain thing works, science works, and the atom bomb works, and napalm works, and everything works. Brainwashing works to some extent. But the point is, what does it work? And why should it work? And what is back of the essential values which make it work? And whether it should work is another matter. Now, the basic concept back of all those series of symbols, whether it is the I Ching or the Sabian symbols, and some other symbols like the tarot cards also, and other things which have been developed along such lines, is that all existence is cyclic. That is to say, there is unity in the world, there is unity in space, the universe is one complete total organism, and it is one in time. That is to say, time is cyclic, it is a unit. It starts from an alpha state, a beginning, it reaches to a point of maturation in the middle, and it ends into what Teilhard de Chardin called the omega point, the seed point, the harvest of that whole cycle. Now, this is really a very basic thing. All existence is cyclic. We are aware of existence in terms of wholes, W-H-O. And everything that you deal with, whether it is a plant, a man, a planet, a cell, any activity of life which has a harder structured and more or less permanent character, permanent within certain limit of time, whether it is a second or 100,000 years, all of such things are wholes And they are whole in space, they occupy a certain space, they have boundaries, they have limits. The universe of Einstein is a bounded universe, it's not a finite universe. It has no boundary in the sense that you will never find a wall to hit, but it is finite as a planet, as a circle, as a sphere is finite. You can turn around it indefinitely, but there is a finite space, it is a finite entity. So that we have what I, in my book, The Planetarization of Consciousness, which is my essential book of basic philosophy, which underlies all my approach to astrology and the arts and everything. What we are dealing there with is what I call psychocosm. Holes which are whole in space and they are whole in time. They have a definite cycle and they have a definite space. They are cosmos, they are universes. And life, existence, is a process. It is a process which goes on from the beginning of the cycle to the end of the cycle, and which gradually animate, fulfill the whole space which is covered by that particular cyclocause, that particular existence, that particular organism, if you want to put it that way. Now, because it is a process, it has also some sort of a purpose. You don't start a process unless there is some sort of a purpose. So that what is potential in the beginning, what started in the beginning of the cycle, comes to a certain degree of fulfillment. It may not be at all total fulfillment, but it's a certain degree of fulfillment at the end of the cycle. And because there is lots of unfinished business, then there is another cycle that goes on and definitely, because every potentiality of energy which is released can be released either in a constructive, both in a constructive and in a destructive form. You work with the process or you work against the process. And therefore, at the end of the cycle, there is that which reached fulfillment because it has worked perfectly with the process, but there is also all that, the waste products, the manure, if you want, which has not been able to fulfill the process, has either fought against it or drifted by the way or tried to escape its difficulties and so on, and dropped by the wayside as waste products. And this is the condition which starts another universe, another cycle forever and ever. Amen. Now, the moment you have a cyclic process, you have phases in that process. Now, if you are building a car in an assembly line, which is some sort of a process, you start with something, you end with finished car, and there is a number of phases which are operations which are necessary to actualize fully what was potential in the blueprint of the engineer who designed the car. So that fulfillment, actualization of the potential at the beginning of the cycle, that actualization process has a number of phases. There are so many operations which are necessary to build a car, and so many operations which are necessary in order to build a perfect human being. It may take lives, if you are looking at it from the point of view of the higher consciousness, or what you might call the soul, or whatever you want to call it. But at any rate, even when you are dealing with the existence of a body who is born and will die, there are certain definite phases of growth, physical, psychological, mental, social, psychic, spiritual, and so on. Those phases, as I said, in the case of a man, don't need to be gone through all, or certainly not all well, because the building of a human being is still a very unsatisfactory and unestablished kind, or unstabilized, perhaps I should say, kind of a process. But phases, there are a number of them. And the more the more complex and higher the level of the development of consciousness, the more multiple the functional activities which are involved in the process, the greater the number of phases. Now, most people live or exist pushed hither and thither by unrelated event, a random event to their consciousness. This happens to them, they don't know why, they don't know what for, they don't know. At best, they can analyze some of the causes which produces those events and perhaps look forward to the result of some of those events. But most of the people live from encounter to encounter, meeting relationship, which to some extent create zigzags in the life process, in what I call, in the deepest sense of the term, the destiny of the man. By destiny, I am not meaning anything about fate or that everything is fully determined or anything of that nature. I mean by destiny simply the process by means of which that which was potential at birth is supposed to become fulfilled, completely actualized, or at least partially actualized at the end of the life. So if there is always that double process, the double factors, the factor of selfhood, that is the process of necessary to actualize that inner potential, which is the self of the person in a certain sense. And there is also the matter of relationship with all the other selves and everything that happened in the environment, which very often, and almost always at first, but very often tend to interfere with the process of actualization of the potential by giving tangential attractions for this and this object which is outside of the process. So most of the people in the world live purely in terms of events, events oriented, and they don't know why they happen. They are not referred to a destiny, they are not referred to a process of actualization which has a definite structure. Now, the great purpose of astrology is not, of course, to predict events and things like that, and even less fortune telling, though that's what it is used mostly for. But it is to help you to understand the structure of your destiny. That is to say, the kind of phases, the nature of the phases through which you have to and you are supposed to pass in order to reach as much as possible of the actualization of your birth potential, and is possible to you under the condition of your birth, your environment, and so on. Now, to the great purpose of astrology and many other things is to transform events, random events, or at least what you think are random events, into phases of growth and development of your destiny. Now, when you do that, when you begin to see that events are phases of a process which is has a basic structure and a basic purpose, and that process is you. You are not outside of it, you are the process. You in the embodied consciousness, in as an organism, as a living person, as a total person, including not only the body, but the psyche, the mind, and whatever may be above it. You as a total person is the total process. And the consciousness, if it is able to realize the structure of the process and the purpose, the general purpose, but especially the structure of the process. See, every event has a phase in it, neither good or bad. This is a completely false attitude towards astrology, but as a necessary phase in the development of your individuality, you know, and destiny. Individuality and destiny are the same thing. Individuality, you look at it from the space point of view, this and this and this and this. Destiny is just the unfoldment of all those potentialities toward the state of actuality. Now, to be able to change an event into a phase of a process in your consciousness actually is the most powerful and most important change that can take place in your consciousness and in your life. You don't need necessarily to deal with astrology in order to reach that change of consciousness. But astrology has a certain purpose and is an ancient idea, ancient type of symbol, which to a large extent can be used for that purpose, even if it is not usually used in that way. Now, this is also really the purpose of the I Ching, because the I Ching is not only a matter of divination, as it's so called, or in a more philosophical sense, an oracle to which you go in order to find the solution of your problem and so on, but it deals with a particular aspect of the human situation at a certain level of cultural evolution and cultural development. Now, every process has phases, as we see, so. But if the process is simple, you have less phases, less operation to fulfill. And so you see, in the I Ching, for instance, which was the expression of a culture which had a very simple agricultural foundation, a very simple pattern of realizing the alternation of the duality of life, the male, the female, the day and night, the yin and yang, and so on, and how all those dualities could be related in such a way that out of the conflict or the tension between those dual forces, meaning could arise. Now, the I Ching starts with the principle of duality. There is the, in the modern version, there is the simple line and the broken line, two lines, you know. In the ancient, the most archaic type of I Ching, there was either, there are two versions, and nobody knows exactly what is true. One said that there was a black disc and a white disc, and another person said that there was a white disc and two white discs. But anyway, it seems quite definite, according to records, that the lines, which we know now as the trigrams, trigrams and hexagrams of the I Ching, were at first circles, discs, and not lines. But that doesn't change the situation. Just for, by way of thought, also at a certain time in the past, Chinese music was, the basic tones of the Chinese music were produced by bells. And it is only later on, in order to make the pitch of those tones more accurate, that they developed a system of what they call luz, which dealt with the length of bamboo tubes, which we could measure according to the length and to the size of the orifice. In fact, they measured it in a very funny way. They measured it by counting the number of grain of millet that could go into the tube of the pipe. Apparently, millet has a very exact size. All grain of millet are very closely the same size. And so when they had a flute, you see, they would just count or see the tube and measure how many grain of millet were in that tube. And you make it smaller if necessary by and taking a few grain of millet out. And it's a very tricky thing, because I remember in my childhood there was a big contest where you made, I don't know, a million francs and all that, by counting the number of grain of millet in a quart bottle. And we tried it, and it's a hopeless task. Anyway, each phase, you see, of the I Ching its trigram, its hexagram, however, has a definite meaning. And there are 64, and there is even more in a sense, because there are changing lines, as you know, and therefore you have a situation which is evolving, which gives you, to some extent, a different picture of possibilities. But basically, there are 64 symbols. Now, in the Sabian symbol, as you will see in a moment, you have 360 symbols. Now, the reason why, of course, is that we are living in a society which is infinitely more complex than the ancient tribal society of ancient archaic China. And so the more complex the possibilities of development, the more complex the type of messages which have to be communicated through symbols to a human being, to a consciousness, which wants to be aware of the meaning of existence and of every event, the more symbols there must be in a complete cyclic series. Now, symbols, I spoke about them a little 2 days ago. I might just stress this fact that symbols are necessary for communication. You communicate through symbols. You communicate meaning through symbols. Now, a symbol may be a word. All language is a system of symbolism. Every word is a symbol. But in language, you have a type of symbolism which is now, anyway, at first it was not, but it has become an intellectual, rational system with a very complex syntax and so on, complex type of relationship between the words and different type of words and so on. Originally, language was cries, animal cries like vowel sound and guttural or any kind of sound, vocal sound. And it is only gradually, as society became more complex and the type of human relationship became also more complex and confusing, that the world became more and more abstract, more and more dealing with general principles, and no longer straight and directly with definite physical experience. Now, symbols, in a larger sense of the term, are really instrumentalities which are provided by our culture, through the use of which we can come to term with and understand and the complexities of life situations. Symbols are essentially cultural products because they are different in every culture. The language is different, the scenes are different in many respects, and so on. The gods have different shapes, and the temples are different, the arts are different, everything is different. There may be a basic similarities and a basic common foundation for certain kind of symbols which are essentially what I might call generic symbols, which belong to the genus Homo sapiens. Because of the very shape of the organs of that body. For instance, ra means something which is similar in practically all language. Pa and ma and all that are also are found in almost all language. And the meaning of the vowel are also different in every language, and more or less common in every language. So that there is undoubtedly a primordial language which was a language which was determined by the shape of the human body, and especially the shape of the throat, the larynx, and all those things of that nature. Now, those symbols, you see, help to focus certain universal ideas, or perhaps I should say archetype. They focus those basic meanings, archetype, form, structure of things, in those particular situations, scenes, which somehow are typical of the quality of response which are implied in those archetypes. You see. Now, the word archetypes can be used in all sorts of ways. And even as Jung, for instance, used them, there is, to my mind, quite a question as to what he really meant in many cases, and he may have changed the meaning of the term as he grew older. But as I use it, and I'm not going to discuss the matter here, as I use it, I am not speaking of something, of a world of archetype, which is more or less somewhere above, somewhere mysteriously in the sky. But I am just speaking of those archetypes as the basic, hard to find words that don't compromise you, as the basic potentiality which are inherent in that set of potentiality which you call man. You see, a man is as an archetype, there is an archetypal structure of man which represents the different features, the different way in which the functions of its organism are related to one another and what those functions are aiming at, purpose of. So there is what you might call the pattern of man. Occultists are speaking very much of the pattern of man, the great man projected into the sky as the great man in heaven. They are dealing with the archetype, that is the essential set of potentiality, which is the foundation of the human species. Now, of course, if you follow the ordinary scientific and materialistic approach, then much of what I am saying makes no sense at all. I take for granted, you see, that there is a creative power, a creative forces, and that a logos, if you want, a world in the beginning which contain the basic set of potential of a whole universe, and if you bring it at a lower level, of a particular type of life which you call human life. So we'll all have that kind of set of potential. But the question is that it is an immense set of potentiality, and each man, each race, each culture is developing more than certain potentiality than others. So that you are characterized, a culture is characterized by the stress of a particular type of archetypes, another culture by another kind of archetypes, and their task as a collective culture is to actualize the potentialities which that archetype represents, you see. And by archetype, I mean really a sort of qualities, of basic qualities of response to life, to relationships, and to situation in one's environment. Now, the very important thing, and all those things are getting straight to the subject, don't think that I'm wandering around aimlessly. all those qualities, you see, which are constituting the set of potentiality which you call man with a capital M, or tiger with a capital T, or wheat, whatever it is, you know. All those qualities are essentially limited in number. And again, it is part of the concept that the universe is finite, that every cyclocos is a unit, and a unit has boundaries. Another way of saying it is that any creative act operates by a quantum of energy. There is release of so much energy, and that energy contains so many potentialities of development which that particular cycle, that particular existent is going to have to fulfill if it grows on to its perfection. Now, there you see, you get the idea, in other words, that there are really only a limited number of basic and meaningful experiences available to a human being. This is, of course, an idea which is completely foreign to our Western mentality, but it is quite well known in the East. It doesn't mean that the type of events which you can experience in your life are always limited. That is not the point. You can have an infinity of experiences, but you can have hundreds or thousands of experiences, each of which have all the same meaning. Only because at the first experience you didn't get the full meaning of that experience, you have to repeat it hundreds of times in a little different way, so somehow or other you will get that meaning in your head. You see. Now, existentially, there is an infinity of possible events and possible relationships. But archetypally, there is a limited number. You see. You have a similar idea, for instance, in the whole Hindu philosophy, which says that there are six basic schools of philosophy, six basic ways to reach the awareness, the consciousness, and full identification with the Atman, the universal self, which is beyond any formulation, beyond any conception, beyond space-time, and God knows what. You see. Now, there are six ways in which you can go to that unity. And if man wants to be completely fulfilled, he has to pass successively through those six ways. And of course, as they had the whole complex system of reincarnations, you incarnated in a particular life, in particular circumstances, so that you would be directed toward one particular way of reaching Atman. If you fulfill that way perfectly at first, which you never did, of course, then you don't need to reincarnate in the same condition. You reincarnate in another condition which will put you on another path, another ray, as Isabella would say, and which also the way in which you can reach Atman in a different way. And then through a series of incarnations, it certainly is not six, it may be 6,000 or 600,000, you pass through all those rays successively. You have known truth and meaning in every conceivable way, and therefore you end into that final thing and you merge into that central sun, which is everything and nothing. Yes. Now, this is, you see, the type of things which is implied in such thing as the I Ching or the Sabian symbols. They are an expression of very basic meanings, the quality of experience, which can be found at the core of hundreds and thousands of different kinds of experience. But however different the experience is, the quality of response to that experience, if it is best met, has a definite character. So that what an oracle does, like the I Ching, when you throw the sticks of the I Ching and all that, is, as it were, to reveal to you the quality of response which is best adapted to the situation that you are worried about. You see. In other words, there are 64 basic ways, according to the I Ching, to meet any life experience. And as you throw the stick, you try to find out which of the 64 of those basic ways is the one that fits into that experience. And it is the same thing with the Sabian symbol, except that instead of 64, you have 360. And that it is a new thing which has not been refined and by a long period of experience and dwelt upon and perhaps modified in many ways. Now, before I come to that, this is in a certain sense, you see, why those kind of oracles have a certain essential quality which is to some extent superior to the kind of oracles that you got from looking at the liver of an animal or the clouds in the sky or tea leaves or anything of that nature. Because those are existential figuration. But you deal there with something which may imply a transcendent archetypal order of qualities. But it is not there for you to see, you see. Whereas in the I Ching and in the Sabian symbol, and the Tao to some extent also, you are seeing there the whole set of archetypal ranges of quality, so that you can see the relationship of one of those oracular pronouncements to other oracular pronouncements, and you are able to see the pattern on which the fulfillment of the archetype man is eventually going to be achieved, at least as far as we can see it today, according to our culture and according to our environment and the development of our consciousness. Now, this is the basic thing. The Sabian symbol were produced by Mark Jones and a woman by the name of Elsie Wheeler, who was a very fine, what you might call, medium, who had an extraordinary psychic, perhaps with better term, who had an extraordinary gift for visualizing symbols and scenes. When she saw people coming for interviews, she saw immediately scenes of all colors and actions and all that. And she was a very fine woman, very dedicated, and also crippled with arthritis, so that she was in a wheelchair and couldn't hardly move, very tiny little thing. I saw her years ago, and Mark Jones had met her and was very much interested in psychic phenomena at that time and various kind of things of that type, and was very, at one time, with another person in New York, he had a set of symbols with ordinary cards, playing cards, and he wanted to have something to do with astrology and zodiacal degree. There was one set by Charles Bell that was printed, and he was interested in it, and he wanted to try to see if he could do something in a different way from a different source. So she was very happy to work with that, because she wanted a gift to be used for the best and highest type of thing that could be done. So Mark went to take her in his car. It was in the early 1920s in San Diego. She lived in San Diego, and took her to the Balboa Park, the big park, you know, that big zoo there, you know, and where there was that exhibition in 1912, I guess. And they parked the car in a little lane. At the time, there were very few people, and quietly, and he had a little pack of cards, you know, ordinary filing card, 360 of those. And in the left hand, right hand corner, there very tiny little thing you could hardly see with naked eye. There was an area sign and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 toes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. He put the thing upside down so he couldn't even see that, and kept shuffling the card constantly, you see, through the whole process. And then he would take one card out and said, "What do you see?" And she immediately would see a scene, and he would quickly write down in pencil the essence of what she apparently told him. Unfortunately, there was no tape recorder at the time. And so it went that. And they did the whole 360 degree in one day. 180 in the morning, 180 in the afternoon, with a little break of driving around the park, I think, after 90. And then he took her to have lunch until far away, so nobody would know them and couldn't have to talk to anybody, and came back. Now, I don't know exactly the number of hours, I never asked him, and but my calculation is that it couldn't have taken more than 1.5 or 2 minutes for symbol. Now that, again, alone is a tremendous feat. Now, when you, on top of that, begin to realize that the thing was as aleatory as possible, because he didn't know what symbol, what sign, degree of the zodiac was presented to the woman. She didn't know even less. And yet, when you study those symbols closely, as I have in the last few years, I'm not sure here, but I mean 20 years, 30 years, a few years, you find the most extraordinary structural pattern emerging of all those symbols. We will go into that, and my book go into great detail, but I'll go a little more, not as much as we have time. So that you have a completely, absolutely fast thing, so that there is no chance for the brain to invent, improvise things, to get dissatisfied, to get tired or anything like that. It was just like bum, bum, something like that, you see. Which in itself is almost superhuman, you know. Try, you know. And then, you see, you had that structural order which emerged out of a completely random situation. And as far as I know, no set of symbols that I have seen, though I have not studied them perhaps closely enough, but no set of symbols that I have seen give significant turning point. For instance, the first degrees of every sign of the zodiac, the degree of the equinox and the solstice, the oppositions, the fourfold things of the cross and all that, even five-pointed stars. And then, even more interesting, or just as interesting as I would say, every five-degree sequence has a certain entity. And you will find that there is the first, the second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth degree have a certain characteristic, because they are the fifth degree, because they are the fourth degree, because they are the second degree. Every second degree is in a certain way, sometimes it's very accentuated, sometimes it's not so accentuated, a contrast to the first. The fourth degree always has something of a technical process. So that you have a five-fold unit there, which repeats itself, of course, three times, 15 degree, and there are 24, what I call scenes, Lars Jones used to call them span and so on. But I have changed many names, and I have reworded some of the symbols, but keeping them exactly the way they were. I mean, not exactly, but I mean the scene, not changing the scene at all, but just perhaps resting, emphasizing a little point, which, you see, Mark Jones scribbled those things like that in a few words, and the next moment he had to print that card. And after, several years later, when he began to be interested in it and gave them to me, and then when I suggested if he wanted to have them in my book, Astrology of Personality, he didn't remember at all, of course, what was said, you see. So it is kind of mnemotechnic kind of things, and which undoubtedly in some cases can be improved a little bit. But I have not changed the main scenes, you see, at all. Just merely somehow a little bit of the formulation, you see. Now, the question which is interesting there, and of course which applies to all sorts of things, is that those symbols which Mark Jones claims, or suggests rather, that there was a tuning in to some ancient occult brotherhood in perhaps Chaldea or Egypt or something like that, and possibly a presence who was serving as an intermediary. Those symbols are typical American scenes of the 1920s period. In other words, the symbols are the expression of the mind of that woman, Elsie Wheeler, who saw it out projected, saw them out projected. So that there are American symbols which apply to the American life. And of course, in a sense, as the world is becoming fast Americanized and computerized and so on, It therefore, in that sense, may have a global validity. But do not expect to have a fantastically abstract or universalistic scenes. They are scenes which deal with everyday life of today, just as the scenes of the I Ching, of the symbol of the I Ching, dealt with the scenes of the life, patriarchal and agricultural life of that period. In other words, the archetypes, those universal images or universal meaning, the potential of response to a situation and all that, which have to manifest through a mind which is conditioned by a certain culture.
This is the end of A Modern I Ching, The Sabian Symbols, Part 1, by Dane Rudyar. The preceding audio is copyrighted by Leila Rudyar Hill and was brought to you by Rita, the Rudyar Institute for Transpersonal Activity. Learn more about Rita or contribute to the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudyar at www.rudyarinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudyar, visit www.rudyaraudioarchives.com.